This is the second day of this April 2012 seven-day session. We will resume reading from the teachings of the 13th, 14th century Japanese Zen master Musō Kokushi. His name is actually Musō Soseki, but the Kokushi means a national teacher. These are, as we said yesterday, these short passages or entries are parts of letters by a very devoted disciple of Musō, who was the brother of the shogun at the time. And these are replies to written replies to this man's questions. Just as greed for worldly things is inhibiting and self-defeating, so also craving for other worldly things prevents the opening of the mind. How many people these days would buy this, this statement, that greed for worldly things is inhibiting and self-defeating? It would be a rare person. In my lifetime, I don't remember greed being so taken for granted and even honored, practically. But he's here talking about greed, for craving for other worldly things, what we could call so-called spiritual things, as being an impediment to practice. Well, what does this mean, craving for other worldly things? Well, the most common, maybe, is craving for peak experiences, psychic powers, and probably the number one hindrance is the craving for enlightenment. At workshops, I often have the question, well, you say that in Buddhism, in Zen, we want to transcend our desires or cravings, but what about the desire for enlightenment? And what I always say is that this is very different than that the desire, the aspiration to awaken for the sake of all beings is altogether different from the desire to get something for oneself. We talked about this yesterday, so we won't have to say much. But it's in the quality of the aspiration, whether it's grasping. Grasping means, I mean, even physically, grasping means putting your hand out and getting your fingers on something and pulling it into to you. And that's not the spirit of what the old texts call bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment or the thought of enlightenment. It's as long as it is, as we said yesterday, as long as it's for oneself alone, as something, some kind of acquisition that we imagine will set us above other people, then this is a great hindrance. It's when that aspiration matures into the wish to awaken in order to free ourselves of the contamination of self-centeredness for the sake of others, that it becomes an entirely different thing. In the original Pali language of the time of the Buddha, These are two different words. Tanha means craving, or this craving implies grasping, wanting to acquire for oneself. And then the other word is chanda, which means the aspiration to do something, not to get something. I guess the word get is the key difference between these two kinds of aspiration. But he is talking about this wanting to get certain powers for oneself, or get experiences that would think they are going to give you something you don't already have. When people are unsympathetic to you and the world does not go as you wish, this should be a help to detachment of feelings from the repetitious cycle of becoming and decay, gaining and losing. So, in adverse circumstances, people who are hostile or somehow we perceive as against us, or the world we perceive as against us with misfortune or loss. He's pointing out that this can be used at these times of suffering as a way to remind us of the need to find a way beyond this, as he says, repetitious cycle of becoming and decay, gaining and losing. I suspect that for most of us, we have to experience some kind of suffering, which usually means seeing the limitations of our ego-centered desires, that we have to run up against ourselves, run up against our self-centeredness before we want to really get serious about finding another way than our egoistic desires, attachments. The problem is that so many people can't use their misfortune and their difficulties in the best way. They just, most people just find, blame others for their misfortune. They focus on the people or the circumstances rather than on the opportunity they have. They're too busy feeling like victims and wanting to blame others than to step outside of that whole dynamic and be willing to think, okay, I'm never going to always get everything I want. I will always be susceptible to loss and to pain. What is it? How can I transcend this whole unhappiness that is embedded in samsara, in the saha world? The withholding of divine aid from those who would become presumptuous, more attached, more indulgent and more shameless, if their wishes were fulfilled, is itself divine aid to such people. And I don't know about this word divine, but of course he's talking about petitionary prayer. We want to pray that things go our way and we get what we want. And that not getting that help from whomever we imagine would be giving us that help, not getting it can be the very best thing for us, truly, in a spiritual sense, if getting it would be, make us more presumptuous, more attached to that, more indulgent, more shameless. And then he says, in a corrupt age, when prayers are not answered, that is itself the answer. There's such a hubris behind a lot of prayer, of thinking that, assuming that if we get what we want, that's really the best thing for us. But what we're wanting is not any ultimate thing. It's based on what? Based on our cravings. Someone once said, what most people are really asking for when they pray to God is that two and two not make four. This is the exquisite distinction of the law of causation. Rather than asking for something that we think will make us happy, we can rely on causation, this great law of causation, karma. We don't have to ask anyone for special favors if we trust in causation and base our lives on that. The next one. The pity that great sages have for ordinary people is not necessarily because of the wretchedness of the human condition in itself, but more because of the great potential humanity has and does not use, the high estate from which humanity has fallen. So it's not, he's saying, not just the suffering itself, but the lost opportunity, the failure to use what we have already in our hands, to awaken to what we already are, what we all always have been. The central benefit of Zen in the context of the ordinary ups and downs of life is not in preventing the minus and promoting the plus, but in directing people to the fundamental reality that is not under the sway of ups and downs. Now, this is pretty much same thing we've been talking about this morning. Getting off the roller coaster. And there's no better training for that than Sesshin, which in the beginning is very much like a roller coaster. Many people report this, of the ups and downs But then as we go on and we learn, and it is a learning process, we learn not to attach ourselves to these ups and downs, these mind states, these different experiences we may have, neither the difficult experiences nor the pleasant experiences. When we learn not to get attached to any of that, then we find that we can sail through these ups and downs. It's as though they're no longer ups and downs, even though there are periods of greater ease alternating with periods of difficulty in our concentration, pain alternating with pleasure, that by not getting involved with these, not clinging to them, or in the case of unpleasant things, trying to reject them or fight them, that's when they cease to be a problem. There's the story of the Indian king who went to the royal jeweler and he said, I want you to engrave on this ring something that will support me at times of misfortune and restrain me in times of fortune. And he said, I'll be back in 3 days. And off he rode with in his entourage. And then he came back 3 days later, and the jeweler bowed and presented him with a ring, and on it was engraved these three words: "It will pass." If in Sesshin we were working on a mantra, that would be a good one: "It'll pass." Oh, you're so proud of yourself and euphoric because things are going so well and you're relatively free of thoughts. It'll pass. You're in the dumps, miserable because of the pain and the thoughts and the tiredness. Rah, rah, rah. It'll pass. I've had the thought of just having a kind of some kind of a tape recorder in Doksan. As soon as the student says anything, it activates a response: "It'll pass." Here's a little bit longer one. Virtue without wisdom is said to be an enemy for three lifetimes. Virtue without wisdom. When the time is passed in ignorance, doing only contaminated good, virtue in hopes of reward, it is not possible to clarify the true ground of mind. This is the enemy of the first lifetime. So, not using our time to see what is the very ground, what is beyond both good and bad, doing good and not doing good. We just waste time if we're caught in just trying to be good, usually in the hopes of reward. And then, as a result of contaminated virtue, this is the second lifetime, pleasurable states eventually develop. So this is the truth. It's not that a do-gooder, I'm using that term to mean one who strives to perform good deeds in hopes of reward, one reward of that might be to feel better about oneself, to raise one's sense of self-esteem. That's contaminated. But the truth is, as he says, that even our virtuous deeds do create good karma for us. Pleasurable states eventually develop. Still, in the realm of emotion, they cause a deepening of mundane attachments. These attachments become influences toward greedy and possessive behavior. This is the enemy of the second lifetime. So, for example, we work in various social service organizations and performing good things, you know, soup kitchens or other things. It is good. It is of service to other people. But if it's tainted by this sense of self, basically, is what this is talking about, and what a wonderful person I am compared to other people who aren't doing these things, then the pleasurable karmic effects of this lead to attachment. So this is how I tend to see people who are in very privileged circumstances. It's because of good deeds they've been doing in the past, help they've been giving to other people in a worldly sense. But then there's nothing stable about that position of privilege. What we might in Buddhism call the realm of the Deva realm of wealth and privilege and beauty and so forth. Because when we find ourselves in those circumstances, it's so easy to get attached to them. Most people, it's what I'm talking about mostly is beauty, the beauty of youth very often. Then this becomes an attachment, and then the more attachment, the more we breed our own suffering when things change. And then that's what he leads into next. When the pleasurable states are worn out, while the force of ignorance has not been diminished, but rather increased by habitual attachment to the rewards of virtue, the fall from the state of elevation of feeling produces negative reactions. This is the enemy of the third lifetime. So the great rock star or movie idol or sports superstar, when the inevitable passing of that happens, then it can result in all kinds of things, drug use and so forth. I think of Whitney Houston. Beautiful, beautiful woman, the voice of a nightingale, but without the underlying spiritual fiber, the stability of the mind, it can result in tragedy. He begins here quoting a sutra called Obstacles of Pure Action, which I've never heard of. But he says it explains how religious practices can in fact obstruct the path of enlightenment. And then he explains, this occurs when those who practice almsgiving despise the selfish. So giving to charitable organizations, but while doing so, looking down on those who don't. When those who observe moral precepts are critical of those who do not. When those who practice forbearance, or patience, belittle those who are impatient. When those who practice vigorous diligence look down on the lazy. When those who practice meditation reject those who are distracted. And when those with knowledge make light of the ignorant. These six instances that he presents here correspond to what we call the six paramitas, the six perfections, that qualities that are developed through through Zen practice. And those six are, the first is dana, or giving. The second is morality. The third is forbearance. The fourth is vigor, or zeal, effort. And the next is meditation. And the last is wisdom. So each of these presents the danger of pride, basically, is what he's talking about. Thinking that we're something special because we give so much money, or because we're so pure in our conduct, or because we have so much forbearance and so forth. And then he continues, acquisitiveness in the practitioner converts religious practice into self-approval and condemnation of others, which obstructs the course of enlightenment. This is, of course, he's not saying that we shouldn't, with all of our means, develop this kind of generosity and moral purity and forbearance and so forth, but rather in doing so, don't contaminate it by looking down on others. And then on the other hand, one of these jumped out at me. Those who observe moral precepts are critical of those who do not. There is a place for criticizing those who are causing harm to others. It's all in how it's done, and this is can be terribly difficult. I think I've spoken of the dilemma I find myself in when someone at a workshop, for example, asks about another teacher who I know to be a nasty person, and I feel somehow besmirched by saying anything negative about that person, but I can't feel good about just saying, sure, go ahead, because people, beginners, can be very naive and stumble into some very sketchy kind of teachers. So I try to craft my words to do it in a way it isn't just disparaging the other person, but still warning the other teacher, rather, but still warning the person asking the question. So in a recent issue of Tricycle, I said a lot of critical things about teachers who exploit and their students, but I felt obliged to do it because I don't hear it much. There's too much of the other side. Who are we to say anything negative? And that's why they can run roughshod for so long. In this case of one teacher, for 40 years of exploiting his students, because not enough people will speak out. Not, you know, people in positions of authority, other teachers. Roshi Kapil used to quote someone else saying, silence is golden, but it can also be yellow. And he would quote Yasutani Roshi as saying, it's the job of a teacher not only to present the truth, but to expose the false. Again, it's all in how it's done. Whether it's done in a spirit of one-upmanship or unnecessary criticism or whether it's really for the greater good. And that is the measure that we use in Mahayana Buddhism in any action. Does it serve the greatest number for the greatest good? The greatest good for the greatest number. A primary aim of Zen is the uncovering of what is known as inherent wisdom. This is not the kind of knowledge that is produced by thinking based on conditioned consciousness. It is said that the ignorant are obstructed by ignorance, while intellectuals are obstructed by intellectual knowledge. This is a wonderful, pithy way of putting it. The ignorant are obstructed by ignorance, while intellectuals are obstructed by intellectual knowledge. And this is another thing to be on guard about in practice, and especially in Sesshin, is that we do have insights. And I'm not awakening, I'm speaking of here, but little insights about our personality, our habits, our tendencies, our dispositions, our relationships with other people. These things can become marvelously clear during Sesshin, things about ourselves and others and how we relate to others and so forth. But this is still not what we call Bodhi, fundamental wisdom of our Buddha nature. It's something else. It can be useful to have these insights. Definitely it can be useful. But it's still in the realm of conditioned consciousness. Still in the realm of acquiring knowledge about ourselves and others. And however useful that may be, it is an entirely different thing, absolutely different thing than losing what gets in the way of true wisdom. And then he just adds, one way of getting past these obstacles and approaching inherent wisdom is to let go of whatever comes to mind. Well, hello, of course. Whatever comes to mind. This is pure Zazen. Even these satisfying insights that come to us from time to time in Zazen, even that to let go of. It's not like we have to mentally hold on to such insights. They have already changed us. Once we've had an insight, we're not going to forget it. We may forget it on the level of just on that level of conditioned knowledge. We may forget it, but if it's a true insight, then we've incorporated it and we don't have to cling to it in the mind. Even the phrase letting go of whatever comes to mind, letting go itself is misleading. It can be misleading because it still implies doing something with what comes to mind. We don't need to do anything with our thoughts. We just need to keep turning the mind back to our basic practice, the koan or the breath. We don't need to do anything with our thoughts. they'll settle on their own. If we can just lose ourselves in the practice, the breath or the koan, the thoughts will settle on their own. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to settle them. We certainly don't want to try to expel them or suppress them or fight them or flee them. There's nothing, not even let go of them. Just swing our attention back to the breath or the koan. That's it. The fundamental is not characterized by intelligence or stupidity in the ordinary sense. Those who are attached to such appearances are the stupid, while those who are not are the intelligent. So maybe in modern terms we could say this has nothing to do with IQ, just as it has nothing to do with acquired knowledge, learning, education. And those who concern themselves with IQ and other things are the stupid, while those who don't concern themselves, are free of such judgments, are the intelligent. And he says, so those who attain wisdom of the fundamental do not pride themselves in being wise. Whenever one notices any flicker of pride in one's attainments in Zen, you can always neutralize that by asking, who is wise? Who's attained something? Who is there? Or, of course, the other surefire way to neutralize that is, what is mu? To take the attention off the self. This is what we're doing here. It's the hardest thing in the world. We reflexively refer things back to the self. It's so such a deeply ingrained habit. When we plant a tree, as long as the roots take, the branches and leaves will naturally grow and the flowers and fruits will develop. Therefore, when we plant the tree, we are concerned about the roots and not about the branches and leaves. As long as the roots have not taken a firm hold, we prune off the small branches so that the energy will go to the roots. Of course, he's talking here about Zazen and everything else but Zazen. That does not mean, however, that we plant the tree for the sake of the roots alone. We take great care with the roots for the sake of the branches, leaves, flowers, and fruits. Beautiful metaphor. So we gotta get the roots established. All benefits stem from a solid, deep practice of Zazen. And when he talks about pruning off the small branches so the energy will go to the roots, it means simplifying one's life. Looking hard at what is extraneous, what is does not serve our practice in a large sense, meaning our ability to manifest these six paramitas, the generosity and the morality and the forbearance and so forth, and the meditation, that's one of them. Looking at what needs, what we need to trim from our busy, busy, busy lives in order to establish these roots, have them really go deep so that they can nourish us, this practice of Zazen can nourish us our whole lives and others, of course. This trimming, pruning the branches is a big part of what the term intensive is for many people, looking at ways to trim away what gets in the way of practice. Things in diet and health, unnecessary reading, relationships that aren't wholesome for us, that may lead us into dark paths, and even cutting down on our involvement in other things that are not the root. Involvement in political concerns, information, stupendous amount of information that we can absorb every day that clog up the works. Probably just about everyone these days who does Zen practice has to make decisions about how to find time for sitting and with everything else they have to do. But to repeat what I've said so often, sitting is not just another activity that's equal to commuting and reading and everything else. Sitting is the basis. It is the root. It's the root that nourishes everything else. The commuting and the shopping and the fitness training and everything else, the relationships. It's the root. It's not co-equal to everything else. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.